Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Morten Flate Poulsen in this episode. Morten is a Nordic distance and online education scholar and practitioner whose work has spanned the globe. His pioneering work dates back to the 1980s, and he's completing a series of anecdotes freely available online, chronicling his impressive career. I'm talking with Professor Morten Flate Poulsen, currently with the Nordic Open Online Academy, following an impressive international career as a leading online education expert, with a series of anecdotes that date back to the 1980s. Morten is a very early adopter of online education and has served for many decades as a pioneer, student, teacher, course designer, system developer, administrator, researcher, professor, author, editor, entrepreneur and innovator. Morten, it's great to be talking with you.
Thank you, and wow. It's good to talk with you as well, Mark.
Thank you. Can we start with just an overview of your career and publications?
Okay, I have in my career of working with distance and open online education, started to work with the NKI distance education in Oslo, Norway, and spent most of my career working from that company. But I also worked for the American Center for the Study of Distance Education as a doctoral student when I studied with Michael Moore and with editors of the American Journal of Distance Education. And there I started one of the first distance education online journals in the world called Dales in 1990. I have also been president of the European Distance and E-Learning Network and worked a short period for ICD as the acting secretary general there. I have been working as a short-time and part-time professor at Universidade Aberta in Portugal and Athabasca University in Canada.
Mm. Fantastic. And of course, there's a much deeper bio, which we'll make available on our website. So, Morten, across all of this time, the theory of cooperative freedom and transparency has been guiding your work. Can you give us an overview of that theory?
Well, it started out that I was working as an ICT educated person in a correspondence school called NKI. And I realized that I could revolutionize the correspondence distance education by using computer technology. And flexibility was always in the spine of what we were doing at NKI. And I realized after a while that my four favorite online education words are cooperation, flexibility, transparency, and celebration. And those four words have been my guiding stars, I think, throughout my career. And it is actually the four most important words in my theory of cooperative freedom and transparency, which I first wrote down as a doctoral student at Penn State as one article in the DEOS, which was circulated around the world on email. But it was also published in a monograph that I published in the early 90s. The thing is that I was very much aware that distance education as correspondence courses, as I was started to work with, was very lonely. It's very individual. And I wanted to use computers to connect students with each other and their teachers. Yeah. I wanted to do it asynchronously so that people didn't need to be online at the same time. So I started to distinguish between collaboration, as people do in groups in ordinary classrooms, and cooperation, which I thought we could do online. And cooperation is working together with other people in networks. and in networks, you're not so dependent on each other than you are working in a group. So I wanted to develop a learning environment which allowed the students to cooperate but not be dependent on each other. So I want them to have as much flexibility as possible, but also have an opportunity to cooperate. I wanted them to have a compelling but not compulsory cooperative learning activities.
Yeah.
So I wrote an article saying that flexibility is something I really want to give the students, and especially adult students wanted to have that flexibility to deal with a busy life and take care of job responsibilities and responsibilities for families. And I had six dimensions that I introduced: flexibility of time, flexibility of space, flexibility of place and medium and access and content. And I wanted to give the students the opportunity to have a lot of flexibility in these six dimensions. But I also realized that more flexibility you give to them, the more difficult it is to have them to cooperate. So that is the dilemma. How can we provide a lot of flexibility to the individuals, but also develop a learning environment that allows them to cooperate if they want to? So that was the basis of what I tried to do. And after a while, I also realized that transparency was important, because it's easier to cooperate with people if you know something about them. So allowing others to see information about you and your work and the school and the teachers would help improve the learning environment. So I focused more on transparency after a few years. But finally, I also realized that we like to be celebrated, and we introduced badges and talked about students that did well and so on. So it's also a part of celebration that I try to include in the learning environments that I would like to build. So that is the theory, which has evolved over years since about 1990. But it's always been my guiding star when I tried to develop courses and learning environments. And I think it's still what I'm trying to do and to achieve. And it's still difficult, but I'm striving towards that.
Excellent. And of course, technology has moved on a lot since the 1990s. So I'd imagine that theory can now be expressed in many different ways compared to when it was first mooted in the early 1990s.
Yes, absolutely.
I think, though, and drawing from your fascinating list of anecdotes, which we will link to from our website, you've got some really interesting entries dating back to 1986 and 1987. 1986 talks about designing the first LMS for distance education. 1987, teaching Norway's first distance students online. Now, for many of us, distance education online started in the 1990s, but here you are almost 10 years ahead of the pack. Can you tell us a little bit about those 1986, 1987 reflections?
Yes, I was, as I said, working in a correspondence school, but I was also an ICT guy who started with some of my colleagues, the first private ICT college in Norway, face-to-face. And there I had some really good students working with me, and I challenged them to develop something that I called ECHO, for Electronic Combined Education. It's a Norwegian acronym. But I challenged them to develop a program, a system that would allow students to connect with each other and their teachers via email, computer conferencing, with class rosters and those kind of systems. And they did that as their student project in 1986. So we actually had a system up and running, and I used that as a part of my face-to-face classes, I put out my notes there and the assignments to the students, and then they got to the computer lab and they started to communicate with each other from their PCs there and answer my assignments, and they could see the other student communication. So it was actually a learning management system that we had developed, but it was on the school. It was on a Hewlett Packard 3000 computer. Mm-hmm. But it was successful and the students liked it. And the next year, we attached a pool of modems to the mini computer so the students could dial in from their dormitories and communicate with the school and each other from home via the PCs and modems. Mm. And then we realized that this was possible to deliver distance education courses through. So in the fall of 1987, I taught a course called Introduction to Computer Science through this ECHO learning management system to real distance students who lived several places around Norway, and they connected via modems and their PCs. And it was some technical challenges, but three of the four students completed this quite challenging course. And it was a pioneer stunt, but mm-hmm. we succeeded. And the next year, we offered three courses, and we went out to the major newspaper in Norway and offered these courses for free. And we got 100 students enrolling to these three courses the next year. And from then on, we were offering and dealing with online education, which was growing year by year at NKI. And I've been really pleased to work with this every year since, and it's still fascinating.
Mm. So, Morten, it sounds as though you've also introduced the first MOOC back then in the late 1980s.
Well, the first M, the massive, is not. we had quite few students at the moment, but realized that very, very few people had PCs at that time, and very few of them then could attach it to a modem and communicate. So it took quite a while before this was commonplace. But we gathered a lot of experience, and it was a great success year by year. And we grew to become the Scandinavia's largest distance education provider.
And it sounds as though, too, during those years, the foundations were laid for the theory of cooperative freedom and transparency, which you articulated in the early 1990s. From there, it sounds as though online courses, web-based courses, really took off. And another entry in your anecdotes is from 1996, launching the first web-based courses, that following going online in Birmingham and Berlin. Can we check in on 1996 and the first web-based courses?
Yes. We realized that using the ECHO learning management system was working very well, but it was closed in a way that you had to dial in through dial-in phones. And when I was in the US from 1990 to 92, we started to work with internet, and I realized that future distance education online would need to be on the internet, because it was so cheap to communicate and it gave you access to all those wonderful resources of learning. So we started to move our online school onto the internet in 1992, but that was before the web was there. So we had all of these more difficult services like listserv and FTP and email services. But it all came together when we got the web which kind of integrated all these difficult services into one. And I remember we had the Winter Olympics in Norway in 1994, which was the year the first web services started to really get some attention. And we started to work on having our school on the web in about 1994, but it took some time to really get everything up and running. So we introduced the first web-based courses in 1996. Then the web was well known, and many more people had access to computers and the internet. So it was a completely different environment where this could be a commercial success, we realized. The challenge was that we had very many students coming from our correspondence courses and from our ECHO courses, and a lot of information was stored in our student management system. And the challenge was to integrate the student administration system with the web courses and our web management system, which we, by the way, called SESAM. But in 1996, we had the first courses on the web up and running, and we had started to have a real integration with the student management system, which, for example, allowed us to check whether the student had paid their tuition fees, and we could upload the grades they have from previous exams and all that kind of stuff. So then we could start to show a lot of interesting information to the students and the teachers and allow them to have a much better graphical user interface.
So when you talk about pioneer in the introduction, these are really pioneering times, and you're doing some very impressive work leading the pack, I think, in terms of what's possible in the online space. 2001, you talk about introducing M-learning, which again is it predates my first encounter with that term of M for mobile. Can you tell us a bit about 2001 and what introducing M-learning was about?
Well, the work we had done so far from a tiny country as Norway got some attention. We had been invited into a European project with partners at the Open University in the UK and partners in Portugal and partners at the Deutsche Fernuniversität. So we kind of was recognized as people that was interesting to work with. And we also were invited to work with the Ericsson mobile phone company in Ireland and Desmond Keegan, who was there, to check out if we could use some mobile technology together with our online courses. And we had several projects. I remember we had an iPack was a small pocket computer, which we could hook up to the wireless internet at work and could show our courses on this small screen. And that was a breakthrough for mobile, because at that time, the internet was becoming wireless. People had started to get Wi-Fi at home, and hotels around the world started to provide that. And suddenly those kind of gadgets made it possible to be even more mobile than we had our laptop computers. And then came the first computers, the mobile phones that we could connect to email, and also having screens so that we could show the web pages. So we were able to use our phones to connect to the learning management system, and we supplied some of our students with this equipment, And I remember we had one student traveling around Africa with a mobile phone and was able to follow our courses. But we perceived the mobile phones as just an entry point to the learning management system, and tried to make the web pages accessible for that kind of gadgets as well.
Mm-hmm. Of course, all of this led to quite a bit of international exposure. And in 2002, you talk about touring universities in Australia. So you have been down this part of the world. What were some of the highlights of that trip, and what were you talking about? What impressed you as you went through the universities in Australia? What messages were they appreciating?
Well, that was a really, really nice experience in my life. We were a group of about 30-something Norwegian and Swedish distance education and university people that visited quite a number of universities in Australia. And we realized that in many ways, as we knew, Australia was a pioneer country in many aspects of distance education and technology. But what I remember most was that I understood that politicians had decided that export of education would be one of the major industries in Australia. And that was so strange to us coming from Scandinavia. We never ever thought about exporting courses or programs or education. And we saw how aggressively some of the people working at Australian universities try to attract students to come to Australia, but also to sell their online courses to our Norwegian and Swedish students. And I think that was the major impact that I took with me home to see that. And I had and still have a thought that education would be much more a global service than it's actually been. And it seems to me that education still is very much national markets. But I thought, and I still think, that education will be much more global than it is.
Mm. I think for Australia and also New Zealand, a lot of the international student body comes because they want the Australian and New Zealand experience. So they do actually come on site as much as they can.
Yep.
There's many, many anecdotes I'd like to pick up on, but one perhaps to finish with. 2007, you talk about searching for mega trends in online education. What are some of the mega trends that you identified in 2007? And is it possible also to relate them to today, some 15 years later?
Wow. That was a large project that I worked much with, and I was really fascinated by the work. I worked closely with Desmond Keegan on this.
Mm, yeah.
But we were a group of good people, my boss Torstein Rekkedal, among others. And we started to see that their web-based or online education started to become big. And we wanted to try to identify the larger European and international providers of online education at that time, and to figure out why they succeeded and what we could learn from them.
Yeah.
And we did identify more than 100 institutions, and we did in-depth interviews with people in charge of that programs or technologies, and tried to synthesize some of the learning. And I'm not sure if I can give you one or two very good learning outcomes of that now, but all the recommendations are listed in the anecdote that I've written there, and I still think it would be worthwhile to look at them, because I think that many of the same issues are relevant now.
Mm.
The more controversial thing we did was that we also identified the major projects that did not succeed, that was stopped after spending a lot of often public monies. And I think it's even more to learn from those initiatives. And I wrote an article which was quite controversial called Resting in E-Learning Peace about these institutions. Mm-hmm. One thing I really would like to do is to reconnect to these mega providers of online education now many years later and see what's happened with them and see how many that are still successful and why. So if there's someone out there that would collaborate with me on such a project, that would be wonderful to revisit these mega providers.
Mm-hmm. Cast your mind back then to that article, Rest in E-Learning Peace. What was controversial about it at the time?
Especially the people who had been in charge of the institutions, of course, did not like me writing about that. But also people who have spent public money and politicians and so on. Of course, it's much better to succeed than to be disrupted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was certainly a lot of ambition back, I think, in the 2000s as to where online education might go. Certainly there are a few overstated possibilities there where online education might close all universities, how everything might be disrupted by this. And I think we've seen parts of that, but certainly not to the scope of what was in mind at the time. Moritan, your list of anecdotes is absolutely fascinating. I note that currently you're up to 2013 and you're still working away at these recollections. Certainly want to recommend them to listeners. They are fascinating accounts of how online learning has evolved, but also the impressive work and career that Moritan has had to date. And you're also planning on taking them forward as a book.
I hope that when I've finished writing about 2020, which I guess I will be able to do during next year, I will come back to the anecdotes and improve them, and hopefully I will find someone who's willing to publish it.
Mm, I'm sure you will. They're absolutely fascinating. Moritan, but before we finish, it is now 2022. You've seen online education evolve over the last 35 years. How has online education evolved? Where is it at the moment from your perspective?
I think that we have seen a few decades where online education has been dominated by first correspondence schools and open education institutions that very much focused on flexibility and openness, had quite much of success and been able to innovate the whole field. When we have seen that these initiatives have been successful and large and financially sustainable, then traditional universities and public institutions caught their eyes upon what was going on. And they started to try to incorporate some of those thoughts in their traditional university and educational thinking. Mm. And other places, for example, traditional institutions have been acquiring these smaller and innovative institutions. Mm. And we see that there are very few small independent online and distance education available, or at least in my part of the world now. Mm-hmm. And they have been merged with or acquired by larger institutions that hoped that this would make them more flexible, but it has not, in my opinion, happened as much as it should be, because these larger, huge, giants institutions are so big and have so much vested in their traditional way of thinking, so they kind of do not change much when they acquire or merge with these smaller institutions. Mm. So I think that it is a danger that we have less innovation now, and we also see that there are national quality standards and quality boards and systems that try to encourage innovation, as long as it's done in the way that the traditional universities do it, which is a little bit worrisome. And I have fear that as we go on, the flexibility will be not as good, and the innovation will be difficult if it should be inside these large institutions that are more or less still stuck in thinking about face-to-face teaching as their standard. And they tend to think that if we are doing online education, we should do it in Zoom or something that is more or less like what we are doing in the classroom. And that is disturbing me, because online and distance education is so much more than the webinar we see all around us now.
Well said. That's certainly dear to my own work as well, in terms of operating models and transforming universities. Yeah, very, very interesting observation. Martin, no doubt there have been many who have influenced you over the years. And I will refer listeners back, of course, to your anecdotes where so many names are listed, so many leaders of education, so many people have actually influenced the shape of distance education and online learning. Are there any individuals that really stand out for you, those who have made a particular impact on you and your thinking about online education?
Well, of course, my boss for many years, Professor Torstein Rekdal, is the one that has influenced me most and encouraged me to dig into both research and going to conferences. So I'm very thankful for everything he has done to me. But there are so many people that I should have mentioned, and if you start to count how many wonderful people I have been talking with in my anecdotes, it's incredibly. But I would like to say, Mark, that when I read through the list of the people you have interviewed so far, there is male dominance, and I would encourage you to include more women. And there are a few women that I really have appreciated working with. Unfortunately, Ingeborg Bø, who has passed away, but she was a very nice and helpful mentor for me. I also very much appreciated to have the opportunity to communicate with Asha Kanwar at the Commonwealth of Learning, and also Tian Belavati, who was the president of ICD. Those are women I think you should have a talk with.
Thank you, Martin. Yes, I have talked with Asha. I note too, in your anecdotes, you do mention Robin Mason as well, who made a big impact on me when I was studying with the Open University.
Yes, absolutely.
Martin, you are the very definition of a leader and legend of online learning. It has been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for contributing to the podcast. And I'm sure listeners will find your anecdotes a very, very helpful set of reflections, but also just wonderful in terms of the insight they provide. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Thank you very much.
You can learn more about Martin and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.